once more into the breach, dear friends.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone number to call in here, presuming that it is the 21st of July. I'm not sure how that happened, where you are, and it's also the year 2018. Would be 254-773-1400. And there's a whole AT&T phone here with lots of little buttons on it.
Right.
That means we can actually get more than one telephone call at a time.
Yeah, it's up to two now. Isn't that amazing?
I think this telephone looks like it actually came out of the 90s instead of the 70s.
Yeah, so it's a step forward. When we first started doing this radio program, it was at the old downtown KTEM building. And it had been in that building for many decades, and it had a big studio, and it had two producer rooms with the windows to look in, and now it's a little cubby hole. But the studio...
I've seen bigger closets than this room.
We had 12 lines available, and on several occasions in my early memory of radio, they were all full. Everybody called in. So radio has changed a bit. You were saying this, one of your grandkids, my nephew,
trying to explain,
3-year-old, doesn't know what radio is.
I tried to explain to him this morning I was going to go do a radio program, and he didn't know what I was talking about.
Ray?
I don't believe he ever heard.
Radio?
I don't believe he's ever listened to the radio.
No, why would he? And he's got podcasts, and he's got handheld devices, and why would he listen to the radio?
It's something that's going away, you know. I mean, we say that we're KTEM AM 1400, but we also have to put in there www.ktemnews.com.
Right, or you go to thepersonalwealthcoach.com, and there's recordings of this of the programs we've done in the past. It's not available live there. That'd be one of the things we can maybe get an intern for at some point, is updating how we do podcasting and so on.
Yeah. Well, the good news is the economy is booming. I guess it's one of the things I wanted to emphasize here. I talked about the fact that the economists are pretty much in a consensus. We have a call?
No, I was on that subject right at the end of last hour.
We're pretty much in a consensus that we're looking very seriously. And of course, it's 2 years out, so it's a long time. But a 2020 recession. But we're also... The economists are also almost, everyone I have read says 4% or possibly higher will be the annualized GDP growth that we see for this quarter, the second quarter.
Right.
When it comes in the near future, when the Commerce Department finally says, okay, here is the annualized, that's not that much in that quarter, but if it were to do that all year, we'll have over 4% growth. The thing that I wanted to emphasize, and I've noticed that people have forgotten this, this has happened 3 times in the last 8 years. We've had 4% GDP growth in a quarter. In 1 year, we actually had 2 or 3 quarters of that, and we had negative GDP growth in another quarter.
Right.
And it still only came out to 2.3%. So get excited.
Enjoy this.
We got a boom going on. We have a record low unemployment. We have record low jobless claims. But don't think it's going to go on forever.
Right. And people, you know, with the last hour, we talked about the negative sides of trade tariffs, of trade war. We do have a good big boost that I need to tell you about based on the trade war. It's a temporary boost, but it's one that is vitally important. It's a big deal. And that is the Bureau of Labor Statistics. As you're so fond of saying, it's one of our favorite bureaucracies.
They admit to be bureaucrats. The Bureau of Economic Analysis and the Bureau of Labor Statistics are places I would just love to go visit, except for the fact it would probably pop my bubble.
Right. It's probably not what you expect from bureaucrats. They came out with the productivity numbers for June, and there were four sectors of the economy that had a more than 4% productivity growth.
Hmm. What were they?
I want you to guess the first two. I think you'll probably hit it pretty close on the the top three?
I really...
What is there a lot more demand for inside the United States because of tariffs?
Steel.
Steel. Yeah. Iron and steel mills and ferro alloys. Productivity per unit produced and time amount produced up 9.4%.
Cool.
This is one that's a little bit off to the side. Leather and hide tanning and finishing was up 7.8%. But then the next one you would expect is alumina and aluminum production was up 7.3% as far as productivity goes.
The next one will be washing machines.
Right. Well, that happened before, only it's in the manufacturing sector. We could see it happening. It was kind of mixed in with oil and gas stuff, so it was hard to separate out. But this is by industry. And iron and steel mills, their productivity went up 9.4%. That means that if you're an employee at an iron mill or a steel mill, the demand just shot up and the prices just shot up for your product. It's going to be hard to hire new people. So keep that in mind in here. It's going to be hard to hire new people. You'll have to pay more for those people when they come on, and you've got to take existing people off the line to train the new people. So anytime you see a boost in productivity that's that high, it has to be temporary or it's a startup. And if you think of a startup, they tend to burn out more often than succeed because people are being asked to do more than they can reasonably do long term.
Unless, of course, they're automating.
Unless they're automating. In this case, it's too sudden. They didn't get the opportunity to get automation in there. And I expect that that will be something that comes along, but that's a five-year process.
Here's the issue, and this came out of Fitch Ratings, which you probably never heard of, but
I've heard of Fitch Ratings. They,
I'm talking about the people who listen.
It was the ubiquitous you instead of the you.
One.
Right.
The plural one.
Right.
Okay. Anyway. Fitch issued a warning this week that commercial capital expenditures, which we refer to in economics as CapEx, that's investment in new equipment, buildings, and the like.
By companies.
Right. Which, generally speaking, because of the changes in the tax law, there was an assumption at the time the new tax law passed through, before the tariffs were imposed, that we would see a boom in CapEx because...
There's incentives for it now.
We get a big write-off for buying new equipment and for companies investing, making capital investments in their own firm. Of course, inadvertently, the tax law written in a hurry left four words out, so if they improve the building, then it's...
You can't write that off.
They actually have higher taxes on it, but...
And that was a mistake, and everybody that was involved in that said that was a mistake.
Right, but the point is... We had 6% growth last year in anticipation of the tax law in CapEx. And it was assumed that we would see an accelerated growth this year. But in fact, Fitch is now saying it looks like for 2018, we're only going to see half that growth, 3%. And most of it was concentrated at the very beginning of the year. And they're seeing a pretty rapid decline in investment in new manufacturing equipment and so on. Again, anecdotally, we don't know the exact reasons because it's really hard to measure these things. Anecdotally, the owners of companies and so on that are making this decision say they put these investments on hold because they don't know what effect tariffs are going to have on their ability to make a profit if they invest in new equipment and buildings and so on. So that's another warning that things are pointing in a different direction. And that follows... 20% drop in the price of copper. Copper is a powerful leading indicator for manufacturing in that almost everything you do, you have to have. And a big piece of that drop, by the way, is because China, the biggest consumer of copper, suddenly had a dramatic drop in demand in China. And this is all things that the last time we saw this happen was in 2006 and 2007.
Okay, I'm going to take a moment to say something we've said already. We say it a lot, but people aren't hearing it because they're hearing our warnings. And that's important. You should hear the warnings.
Mm-hmm.
So take a moment and just listen to this next part. Times are great.
Yes.
times are amazing right now. So hold on to that for a second. Don't lose that in the warnings that we're giving. You know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are these concepts that we hold near and dear. Every once in a while, stop the pursuit of happiness to just be happy, because this is one of those times you can do it. Times economically are good. If you're listening to this program, you probably have a job if you want one. That's not a normal statement. A normal statement would be most of you have jobs if you want one. At this point, if you want a job, you probably already have it. It's not all the cases. So enjoy it. Save and enjoy and prepare.
I want to emphasize something here, too. The standard leading economic indicators, not these long-term indicators that aren't as reliable, but when you get a lot of them and you begin to pay attention, the standard leading economic indicators from the Conference Board are pretty much unanimous in one thing. We're going to have no recession for the next 12 months or so. Now, that's not a guarantee we won't have a recession, because in some outlying event could occur, that black swan event that we don't know about. But it looks like for the next 12 months or so, we have got a healthy boom economy. And very frankly, this is, Jeff, my personal opinion, we'll see the stock market, barring, I don't know, the president could continue to mute it, but earnings keep rising, which means the market keeps getting cheaper. There's every reason to believe that the end of this year we'll see a significantly higher stock market than we have today with what we're seeing today. That's not a prediction. That's just probabilities look really good that the stock market's getting cheap, and eventually people look at that and say that's really a bargain. We ought to get in
too
there.
Cheap. We better buy. I wanted to throw in a definition in here, or at least a historical reference. You said black swan, and most people that aren't involved in the economic world don't know what that means. But it was as a group of British theologians and statisticians from the 1400s had this concept on statistics that they would say that's as likely as a black swan, because nobody'd ever seen a black swan before. They just didn't exist. There's only white swans. And then they found Australia. And there's a lot of black swans in Australia. That's the standard swan in Australia. So when he says a black swan event, it means that there could be things we don't know about yet. And if you ever hear an economist make a prediction without making a reference to black swan, then they're probably not really an economist, because we can never know enough. What we can know is what's history and how do we make our decisions. And pretty important to understanding that is the expectation for a black swan in Britain is still pretty low. It's a pretty low statistical event. That doesn't mean they don't exist.
Yeah, it was 1697
that they found the
first black swan.
Right, and they went.
So it wasn't the 1400s.
No, they were the statisticians in the 1400s referred to the black swan.
Ah, yeah, okay. So a black swan was an impossible thing to happen because they were all white.
Until the 1600s, and then they said, whoa, wait a minute.
Incidentally, the Queen's swan census has now been completed. There's an annual swan census. Did you know that?
Where is that?
The swans in the Thames River in London officially belong to the Queen.
Uh-huh.
Or the King, in this case, to the Crown. And apparently every year, because one of the kings from a long time ago decided it was very, very important to count all the swans to make sure people weren't swan poaching. Now there's conservation organizations that go out and count all the swans in the Thames and tag them. And they wear the garments that were worn when they were first done. It's a big deal to count the swans, and apparently there is a slight drop in the quantity of swans in the Thames because of the bird flu last year.
Oh, well, that's sad.
So, but they found no black swans.
No black swans.
No black swans in the Thames.
It's really hard to find them in the Thames.
Yes, you have to go to Australia to find them,
or the zoo.
Yeah. So I just thought you'd. Anyway,
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
what it boils down to is in the short term, we have a boom going on. We'll probably see a higher market later in the year. I have no guarantees on that. Interest rates are likely to rise. The president criticized the Fed this week for raising interest rates, which I think is terribly ironic since he criticized the Fed in 2016 for maintaining artificially low interest rates. But the fact that the president criticized the Fed for high interest rates.
And this could be any president.
This has happened before. That means we're going to have higher interest rates because the Fed has to maintain its independence. And if they were to say, hey, yeah, we were going to raise interest rates every quarter into the foreseeable future, which is basically what they said earlier. If they were to skip a quarter at this point, everybody would assume that the president had influenced the Federal Reserve, and that ain't going to happen. So you'll see one interest rate rise per quarter going forward into 2019. It's just a matter of when they stop.
I'm going to hit productivity again because I think it fits in with what you're saying here. Because that psychological reaction by the Fed, if any president says stop doing something to the Fed's required to be independent. They've got to show their independence, and they tend to do the opposite of what the president says just to show their independence.
Which is why presidents traditionally don't say anything about the Federal Reserve.
Right, because it doesn't work out well. It really almost, I've never read it working out well.
The last president to criticize the Federal Reserve for higher interest rates was Jimmy Carter.
No.
Really?
One more since then.
Who's that?
He didn't do it publicly, but he spoke with Greenspan about it, George H.W. Bush. And it cost him his reelection. There was a recession going on based on Greenspan's push for higher interest rates, and Bill Clinton used "it's the economy, stupid."
Mm-hmm.
And
I didn't know HW talked to him.
Yeah, Greenspan, in hearing him speak several years back, he said that George H.W. Bush came to him and said, "I respect the independence of the Fed,
but
please don't do this. Please don't do this now. It's going to cause economic downturn." And it did. That was the intent, but it also affected the election. I was going to come at productivity through this concept, this reverse psychology concept, because while I just said that productivity growth was huge in these sectors that have a tariff on them, we've had productivity growth of large proportions in long-haul railroad for a long time. We're having productivity drops now. So we have, looking across the productivity spectrum, we've got lots of growth, except when you get into agriculture, construction, mining machinery, and long-haul railroad, long-haul trucking. We're seeing drops in productivity there because they've been under too much demand for too long. And this is the psychology I wanted to get into. Imagine yourself at a business. You're making something major. And the boss comes in and gets everybody together and says, "We just got a record-breaking order. It's going to be a lot of hard work, but we can do this. It's probably going to lead to pay raises. We can get it done, guys. Come on." So everybody gets together and says, "All right, go team." And they work their tails off. They're not necessarily working overtime, but they're working a lot harder because they know they've got to get this thing out there. It's the businesses depending on it. If that becomes the norm, if the boss just keeps coming in and doesn't congratulate and say, "All right, we met that goal. Come on, guys, you did great. Now we've got two more record-breaking orders. Keep working at this speed." There's only so long you can go that hard. You can go hard, but if you're going really hard, really big growth in productivity hard, for a long period of time, you're going to hit burnout. And we're starting to see it in construction, agriculture, and mining machinery. We're also starting to see it in long-haul railroads. So keep that in mind. There's only so much you can ask people to do before you either have to hire people. If there's not people to hire, you really have to raise the pay and expect the productivity to drop a little bit at some point because you can't maintain that level of production unless you get new equipment.
You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. I like to talk about something that if you are in retirement particularly, and you have a 401k or an IRA and you're withdrawing money from it monthly to support yourself, that you need to pay attention to. And one of those things is that we're in good times. Matter of fact, I saw a really scary word, Jake.
Uh-oh. What was scary?
It was in Moody's U.S. Macro Outlook, Dangerous Curve Ahead. It's Moody's Economics. Used to be called DismalScience.com. By the way, by Mark Zandi. And Mark Zandi, by the way, is one of the people who predicted very accurately the 2007, the downturn that was 2008-2009. He predicted the severity of it. He's done a very, very good job of predicting. And he said, this is his lead in this thing, economic growth is accelerating. The typical American is feeling good about things.
3 minutes to your next Fox News 30:30.
Even euphoric. Did you hear that word?
I heard euphoric.
And then I read an article that indicated that business sentiment is, quote, euphoric, end quote.
Yikes.
And that indicates we're near the top. So let's just say we are. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, and we could be wrong on this, that 2018, 2019 are the boom years. These are the good old days. And you are either going to retire, or you are retired and you're drawing on an IRA, let's just say, that you rolled over your 401k to an IRA and you're drawing on that, and that's your source of income going forward. That's a primary source of income. There's a guideline that has stood the test of time, and that is if you have a fairly well-balanced portfolio, and I certainly hope that's what you have and not one that's excessively aggressive at this point. So there's a tendency. There'll be a tendency this year or next year to get too aggressive. 4% is a withdrawal rate that's generally considered safe. And why do we say 4%? If we get a combination of inflation and a recession, we get stagflation, which is a distinct possibility given the economic forces, in a couple of years, how are you going to deal with it? In other words, do you have room to maneuver? We encounter people who are withdrawing, for instance, 6%. And sometimes even more from their portfolio every year.
Per year, yeah.
And they manage to hold their own in good times. But if you're in that position where you're withdrawing 6% from your portfolio, strongly recommend you find some way to get it down to 4. And at the same time, accumulate cash. Because it's even if it doesn't happen in 2020, this is the law right now, well, as of August, presuming that we don't have this market crash between now and August, we will have the longest running expansion and the longest running uninterrupted bull market that we've had in since we've been keeping record of these things. Sooner or later, we will get a bear market, and sooner or later, that bear market will be followed by a recession. It's going to happen. It's not a matter of if it happens. It's a matter of when it happens. And the question is kind of like living on the coast and saying, if a hurricane ever hits, that doesn't make any sense, folks. It's when the hurricane is going to hit you if you live on the Gulf Coast. And you need to have a plan for what you're going to do if the hurricane hits. If the smart thing to do is to board up your windows and evacuate, you're living on Galveston Island, for instance, then go ahead and get the sheetrock, not the sheetrock, go ahead and get the plywood now to board up your windows. And the reason I say that is there is inevitably a rush to the lumber stores to get plywood just before a hurricane comes in, and they run out of plywood, and then people don't have something to board up their windows. Look to see if you have flood insurance. Basically, take a look around and say, if we had to pack up and leave tomorrow, are we ready to do it? If you live in California, which would be a bit of a stretch for KTEM, but if you're listening to KTEM, because you could be listening to it on the internet, it's not a matter of if the big one hits, the big earthquake from the San Andreas Fault hits. It's a matter of when it's going to hit. The same thing is true about a bear market in your portfolio, and it's crucial to have a plan to say if the market drops 30%, and I don't think we're going to get another 50% drop, but if it drops 50%, what would I do at that point? What is the plan? Does my portfolio manager have a plan? The people that are if I'm doing it myself, do I have a plan? Do I have the capability of cutting my expenses by 50% or 30%? Do I have cash reserves so maybe I can just turn off the withdrawals for a while? Do I have what we call dry powder, where I can draw on dry powder for 18 months to 2 years without touching the equities in the portfolio? That is the difference between being a successful retired investor and being successful right to the point where you hit the first bear market. There are people that I know of, don't personally know them, thank God, but I know people who, I guess I know one or two now that I think about it, who were financially independent in 2000. Never have to work again the rest of their life. But because of some decisions they either made or failed to make, as we went from 2000 to 2002, they're now in the position where they're working to support their other income. Why? Because they didn't really understand what was going on when the bear market comes. And, of course, we had another one in 2008 and 2009, and it took us a while to recover from that one, too. The 2000 through 2002 was the worst one. It took over 10 years for the S&P 500 to recover to where it was. Is this going to happen again? Yes. How do you avoid it? Well, we're not going to go into that in great detail here, but there are accepted methodologies for preparing for such a downturn. And one is not to get overly aggressive as the market goes up. Believe me, in the near future, I'm seeing the word euphoric. I know we're going to see, why is my portfolio not getting double-digit returns? To have dry powder and to have cash reserves and to look in the middle of this boom at your cash flow and say, are we spending more money than we should? Are we chasing the market upward with higher and higher expenditures? Because that is the kiss of death when it comes to living in retirement from a portfolio that you've built up over many, many years.
I agree with that. There's some discussion back and forth, and I have some points that I say I should raise to increase the message there or something. That was fantastic.
Well, may have something to do with the fact that I've been doing this for 35 years and I've seen enough bear markets now, I'm convinced they exist. But I kind of am getting the feeling that people don't believe in bear markets anymore.
Yeah. And it's funny because after the Great Recession, you would think that people would hold on to that for a while. It's not something that's top of our mind. It tends to disappear when things are going well.
It was 2008 when it started, when the downturn really got started in 2008.
Yeah.
That was 10 years ago. Next year, we will celebrate the bottom about in the spring of next year, May, I think it was, of 2009. We will see the 10-year point from the bottom of the recession, and we have not had a bear market since. 10 years is a long, long time to go without a bear market.
And of course, if you look at 10-year returns,
They stink right now.
They're about to get really good.
Yeah.
We're about to look at 10-year returns and think that everybody's knocking the ball out of the park because it'll be starting from a bottom 10 years ago. The S&P 500 right now is 2801. Now, 2,800. 10 years ago, well, I guess it was 9 years ago, it hit 666.
Yeah, during the day.
During the day. So
it was 676 at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's a big, big shift. Huge shift.
May 9th or something like that of 2009. Tremendous growth in the market, and a tremendous growth in many people's portfolios. And unfortunately, a lot of people were 10 years ago who are getting ready to retire now were just working along and putting their money in the 401k, and they weren't paying a lot of attention to the market. And so it's kind of hard to get your mind around the fact. And we're very contrarian. Let me say this. in 2009, we were talking up the market and looking for good news and talking about all the good news that was out there and good times that were to come.
Right, and people were saying, you guys are always optimistic about everything. And now people are saying, you guys are always pessimistic about everything. Well, it's our job. It's really important.
It has nothing to do with who was president at that moment, believe it or not. It has only to do with the fact that when the market is really, really down, we see wonderful opportunities. When the market and the economy are on a rip-roar boom like they are right now, we see risks. And it's important to have a plan because these good times will not go on forever. And again, telephone number in here is 254-773-1400, but I think we have some
commercials to play. We
sure do.
Commercials
to play for Town Square Media to keep them in business.
One more time, the number is 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Guy.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure on this July 21st. Which is a very interesting number.
721.
Yes, it's 72118. And telephone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we seem to have a caller. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hello? Caller?
Oh, scared him away.
Whoa, they probably thought they were calling for a pizza.
Yeah, so may I have a double anchovy with...
Double anchovy. That
sounds
sound terrible.
Good.
Yeah. I want a meat lover's pizza. That does sound pretty good. So let's see. What else is going on in the big wide world out there? Actually, it's quite a few things. If I can go back to the thing here.
Yeah. Let's see.
2% T-bill. Base metal price drop. Suggest not as well. Bernanke. Copper's plunge.
Without better training, U.S. will fall short on workers, economists say.
Ooh,
that's a big one. Our education for our workforce is falling behind because there's no time for them to stop working to be educated because they're in demand. Go ahead.
Putin did something really interesting right after the Helsinki meeting.
What did he do?
He, and I'm going to presume that very little that's major happens in the Russian government without him being involved. They sold most of their treasuries.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw that.
And they sold most of the last time they did this was just before they invaded Crimea.
Ukraine. Yeah.
Crimea.
That's Ukraine.
No,
yeah.
I'm talking about
used to be Ukraine.
Before they annexed, because they anticipated severe sanctions from the United States.
Well, we could have seized their assets.
Yeah, and since they keep their treasuries like most other nations in the world, when they buy U.S. treasuries, they don't actually take receipt of them. They actually keep them at the Federal Reserve in New York. And they sold them. And
then invaded.
And so this is one of those interesting little signals. There's often been a question, what would happen if a nation that holds a lot of U.S. treasuries, like China or Russia, were to sell all of their U.S. treasuries? And the answer is not much, apparently, because it was just almost an unnoticeable thing. Normally, that would cause the price of treasuries to drop if there was a major sale and nobody was there to buy it. And it would cause interest rates to go up, but we did not see interest rates go up. We saw nothing. We saw no reaction in the treasury market, despite the fact that the Russians sold a lot of treasuries, $81 billion worth, four-fifths of its dollar reserve in treasuries. This is...
So four-fifths, that's 80% of their ownership in U.S. treasuries went out, sold during the week of the conference, the Putin-Trump summit.
Now, when we say sold, they no longer have ownership of it, but now they could have not actually sold it. They could have transferred it to another country that's holding it covertly for the Russians, which is why it wouldn't have had any effect on the market. But that is, that's one of those, I used to work in intelligence and military intelligence, which I know is a conundrum by itself. It's an oxymoron, but that's one of those indicators that something could be about to happen. In other words, This is the kind of thing that Russia has done historically just before it does something where it anticipates international sanctions being slammed on it, which indicates that maybe, you know, it's just one of those things. It could be that one of the...
could be an indicator without anything behind it, but it's a big decision to sell 80% of the U.S. treasuries when dollar reserves are the reserves of most nations.
President Trump had an interesting statement that he couldn't see the United States going to war over Montenegro last week. Did you know that?
I did hear. I read the interview.
Montenegro is a member of NATO, and we have a treaty with Montenegro and with every other NATO country
member,
that if they're invaded, it's like the United States was invaded, and then if they have... If they're invaded and have to declare war, then we will declare war on whoever invaded them. The Baltic states up there are a little nervous about this right now. I don't know. It may not amount to anything. It may not amount to, but it was following the, who knows what they discussed during the Helsinki meeting, but it's economics. The odd thing about it was it didn't affect the Treasury market.
Right.
And the U.S. Treasury and the Russian finance won't comment on it.
There was either a standby large purchaser that bought it all without affecting the secondary market, or it really didn't get sold. It got transferred, as you said. So that's fascinating. And it's when people talk about why are you guys talking politics instead of economics, because in many cases, they're so intertwined, you can't untangle them. This is important to understand. There's a piece, this sounds like a little bit of a segue. It's kind of the same conversation. 5 years ago, 6 years ago, we started talking about kiosks and McDonald's. They hadn't instituted any of them yet. They were testing them.
That sounds very political to me.
Kiosks?
Yeah,
it sounds like a Russian term,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm avoiding all kiosks because I don't like Russian. Wait a minute. That doesn't make any sense. So this concept of automation taking a while. When McDonald's started the research on this, there was a big outcry. Why are you spending money on that when there are so many unemployed people? Well, shoot forward to today, and there's a massive push across a lot of states to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Well, that will cause the cost of a hamburger to go up. It will cause the cost of French fries to go up. And that will cause people to buy less of them. Well, McDonald's does not want people to buy less of their food. That's kind of an understatement of the century. Walmart doesn't want people to buy less of their stuff. Amazon doesn't want people to buy less of their stuff. So McDonald's has been instituting the kiosks. They've been installed in many restaurants, and there are restaurants, you mentioned this last week, but it's not just one, it's lots of restaurants have automated the act of cooking the hamburger, the act of cooking the French fries. They're automating that because it's getting too expensive to handle that machine. If you think about the French fry machine at McDonald's, not anybody's allowed to use that, by the way. You know this, I'm sure.
Not anybody's allowed to use it.
Yeah, when the French fry maker, the deep oil fryer for the French fries at McDonald's.
You have to be certified or something?
You've got to have a certain level of training because it's dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, you could fry yourself.
Yeah, it's very easy to fry yourself. And in thinking about that for a moment, it is not a difficult task, but it's a dangerous task. It's a repetitive, boring, dangerous task. That's what automation will fix, which means that we're going to start seeing, if you go to a McDonald's, you're going to see fewer and fewer people working in the McDonald's and more machines getting you the things until at some point in the future, there may not be anyone at the McDonald's. You may just pull up to the drive-thru. You've already ordered through whatever communication device we're using at the time. Well, we call it a phone now, but it's really a lot more than that. You pull up, you just put in your code, and a box opens, and you take your bag out, and you drive away. That's the future. The present is kiosks. The past, 5-6 years ago, was someone with a slightly more automated picture-based cash register. So when I talk about it takes 5 or 6 years to implement technology appropriately on a large scale to automate a business, if you think about what's being developed now for self-driving trucks, it may be longer than 5 years in something that's that big. It may be more like a decade before the standard is a truck that's driving itself. But it's coming. And this automation, one of the listeners sent me some articles on the year of the robot. It had a bunch of stuff on Boston Dynamics and the robots that they're making now. And when you look at those robots, have you seen the videos on those?
No.
Well, the little dog-looking robot that opens doors.
Yes, I've seen those.
And the humanoid robot that does flips and wanders around and so on. It's really hard to look at that and say, what are you going to use that dog for? It opens a door by itself and it can wander around, but what is it good for? It's just a thing. It's kind of useless. It wanders around, it needs to be charged, and you can't really do anything with it. The functionality is the point. Getting a dog that's autonomous, a robot, we call it a dog, a robot that's autonomous enough to open a door when someone's trying to prevent it from happening, when somebody's kicking it and getting in its way, means that the capability of having a robot that does your dishes and goes out and mows the lawn is in the future. That's going to happen. It may not be a lawnmower that just goes out and drives itself around. It may be that your robot says, you say, go mow the lawn, or you program it in, this is the time of the day that I want you to go out and mow the lawn. It does whatever it needs to do to the lawnmower and takes it out there. That's coming. And at some point, that's the way all industrial facilities are going to look. Lots and lots of robots, some of them holding still and some of them moving around.
Apparently, there's a new hotel opening up in Las Vegas that has robots doing room service. I don't know if you read about that.
That's not too surprising. I have a Roomba in my house, and it's quite effective. It's great. It saves us a lot of time vacuuming. It's expensive, but when you look at early vacuum cleaners as a percentage of somebody's take-home pay, from, say, the 1960s, it's not that expensive. It's a lot less expensive than the early vacuum cleaners that a lot of people bought. So we're heading to a place where technology is continuing to make our lives better. We're at a point right now where we can see some big shifts in that, because the best places to automate are when everybody is employed and you don't have enough to go around. The worst places to automate is when there's a lot of unemployment. You get a lot of bad publicity for automating when there's a lot of people waiting in the unemployment line.
And we're probably going to see more of that, though, anyway.
More unemployment?
I'm talking about automation when unemployment does go up. And then there's a parallel here, and we've talked about this before, but this is the 1920s, effectively, which I think is ironic. We're not, 100 years ago, we're in the middle of World War One, which obviously we're not in that parallel at this point. But the cycle doesn't run a full 100 years. It's a little short of that, this economic cycle, the big one that a lot of people have written about. And at about this point, except it was in the early 1920s, the agricultural world was starting, the late teens, early 20s, was just starting to see a mechanical revolution, and most people didn't believe it at the time. Didn't believe it was coming, didn't believe it was going to happen. Matter of fact, there's a lot of places in the world where it still doesn't happen. There's still oxen or mules pulling plows. But that led to a tremendous economic boom, which I think, for whatever it's worth, let's say we have a recession in 2020, which I think we probably will. This is where I think during that time frame is when we will see robotics really kick in. It's in times of crisis like that that businesses innovate because they're short on money, and the issue is they can't afford to keep the people, but they can afford to, what they do is they find some way to innovate. Like the McCormick Reaper was the Depression of 1837 produced the McCormick Reaper, which put a lot of people out of work in the agricultural business because they weren't there.
One of the reasons for the Civil War in a kind of a weird and backwards sort of way.
And it was the during a recession that Henry Ford decided that he would figure a way to make better cars. It was during a recession that Thomas Alva Edison decided to he got laid off as a telegraph operator, as a matter of fact, and went in his workshop and started inventing all the things that we know of today that Edison invented.
And it was in a recession that a little nearly failing company invented what we consider the smartphone today. Apple started the iPhone in the middle of the Great Recession.
And so, for whatever it's worth, just kind of a gut reaction after a lot of experience and a lot of reading history, I think when we do have, and I think it's, again, very probable that we'll have a recession in 2020, and I think that will mark the big introduction of innovation in robotics and automation. I think it's probably around 2020 when we'll start to see the cars hit the road with that don't need other than minimal driver input to get where they want to go. And the reason is, during boom times, companies can continue to do whatever they were doing because it worked. But when a recession comes and the competition is eating at your, somebody's going to fail and somebody's going to succeed, somebody will come up with a better mousetrap and a better way of doing things, and it will cause them to succeed. The McCormick Reaper, the cotton gin, was invented in a recession in the 1830s, it was the Great Depression of, only it was not called a depression at the time, but it was the panic of 1837 that generated both cotton gin and the McCormick Reaper. People desperate to survive and cut costs when economic conditions are difficult is where we make our greatest advances, at least in the United States. And telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. We've only got about 4 minutes left in this second hour on July 21st. Man, July 21st, 2018. Still sounds like a science fiction book to me.
Right. This is something I wanted to kind of final and underline what you just said. It's when productivity is lowest that we get the most innovation. That's hard for people to think about, but when people have time on their hands, either laid off or out of work for whatever reason, that we have this boost in innovation. And I'm excited because a lot of the automation that we see taking over today was birthed in the recession. The implementation of that automation probably will take another crisis as well. Although what you'll see is companies getting ahead of that and automating now while they can. At some point, it will become just the method that we do it. And it is the answer to the strategic issues that we're facing on lack of steel, lack of everything, is automation. We're going to get to a point where there's an epidemic of black lung out there right now, because coal mining is dangerous, and it's one of the areas that has not gotten easier or safer drastically over the last 100 years. It's gotten safer, it's gotten easier, but not drastically so. There's still big accidents and long-term consequences for doing that. The automation that we're seeing in other industries will eventually hit there too, but only if it's a viable product, if there's a big demand for it and not enough people willing to do it. So what we're seeing in fracking is we're seeing much more automation. We're now at a level of oil production that the nation has never seen before. Texas, by the way, just became the number 3 oil producer in the world. Texas by itself is only slightly behind Saudi Arabia and Russia. You throw in the United States as a whole, it is by far the leading producer of oil in the world as far as any single nation goes. So that concept out there, we're at the most we've produced in the history of our nation and we're employing less people doing it now than we were 5 years ago before the boom. So automation is coming in, and it's happening in a good way. We're about out of time, though, for this week. Just be aware, automation's happening. We're in a great boom time. Save what you can afford to save, and maybe a little bit more, because later on down the road, you're going to thank yourself. You're in a really good place right now as far as the economic times. Do you have anything else to say before we completely
wrap
up?
That's pretty much it. Till next week.
Okay. Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to call us off the air, we have voicemail during the weekend, real live people during the week, locally at
254-947-1111.
And you can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly, Jake or Jeff at tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got newsletters up there. We've got recordings of programs going back many years, so you can check and see how right or wrong we were. Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.